ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 31st of December. I'm David Lipson in Sydney, coming to you from Gadigal lands. Across the nation, people are preparing to celebrate the new year in all sorts of ways, but Sydney's public events will look quite different this year. More than 2,500 police officers will be deployed to bolster security following the Bondi terror attack. So how do people feel about attending big public celebrations this year? Louise Mylan takes a look.
Aussies are gearing up to ring in the new year, each in their own way. In Melbourne, people are making all kinds of plans.
Just hanging out with family.
Yeah, hanging out with family, friends. We've got a party.
Are we going to the fireworks?
Very little.
Do you think you'll stay up till 12?
Probably not.
In Sydney, the annual fireworks display is set to draw a crowd of over a million people. This year's event comes just over 2 weeks after the Bondi terror attack, which shook Australia, leaving 15 dead, dozens injured, and both the Jewish community and the broader public on edge. For locals like Caitlin, the attack is still front of mind.
To be honest, in our house we've spoken a lot about it because we have tickets for the Opera House, and that's an area we are a bit worried about going to. We are still going to go, but definitely not as fun as anticipated. We're a bit more worried and thinking about what could potentially go wrong, which is pretty disappointing.
But many, like Julie, are determined not to let the tragedy hamper celebrations.
We don't want to give in to the terrorists. That's what they want us to do, stay at home.
This tourist in Melbourne shares a similar sentiment.
I feel like we'll celebrate no matter what. I feel like you think about it, but also you don't want to think about it, if that makes sense. So you just keep going about your day anyway.
In the wake of the Bondi tragedy, security is ramping up at New Year's events around the country, particularly in Sydney, where 2,500 police officers will be deployed. Here's New South Wales Premier Chris Minns.
It's not just about confronting terrorism or crime. It's about making the public feel safe when they're out with their family in the community. And for identifiable members of our community, for example, the Jewish community, or for example, members of the Islamic community, where it's quite easy to determine their religion, then we need to make sure that they feel safe in Australia.
This is the biggest police operation of its type ever mounted, and some officers will be carrying long-arm guns, which are not a common sight on Australian streets. New South Wales Police Commissioner Mal Lanyon says the weapons are there to make people feel safe, not scared.
Our Public Order and Riot Squad will be carrying long arms this year. That does not represent any specific threat. It is to provide reassurance to the community.
Sydney local George says he feels reassured by the ramped up police presence.
I guess it makes sense immediately afterwards in case there's any like copycat.
Premier Chris Minns has also been in talks with the federal government about the possibility of deploying the Australian Federal Police and Army. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has not ruled that out.
Security arrangements from New South Wales have clearly stepped up in that, and that's a good thing. But we'll continue to work arm in arm with New South Wales. We'll continue to work as well with our agencies.
As well as the fireworks, the City of Sydney is also holding a moment's reflection for Bondi. At 11 o'clock, the Sydney Harbour Bridge will glow white and a Jewish menorah will shine from the pylons. The city's encouraging people to join in the reflection by shining their phone torches across the harbour.
Louise Mylan there. As the investigation into the Bondi terror attack continues, the Australian Federal Police are turning their attention to a hotel in the Philippines. Footage of the gunman's month-long stay in November has been provided to the AFP. They say one of the alleged attackers was inspired by Islamic State. But they acted alone and it didn't seem they received special training. Kimberly Price reports.
More than 2 weeks after the Bondi Beach terror attack, the Australian Federal Police are faced with a grieving community who wants answers. But it also must consider protecting an investigation and prosecution of one of the surviving gunmen, 24-year-old Naveed Akram.
This is one of, if not the most important investigation that the AFP and our partners will ever do.
Standing in front of the Prime Minister, AFP Commissioner Chrissy Barrett confirmed the two alleged perpetrators spent almost a month in the Philippines before the attack.
The initial assessment from the Philippine National Police is that the individuals rarely left their hotel, and there is no evidence to suggest they received training or underwent logistical preparation for their alleged attack. CCTV footage capturing their stay in the Philippines has been provided to the AFP, and we are currently reviewing that material. What this points to, and I will again advise this is a point in time assessment, is that these individuals are alleged to have acted alone.
While the AFP alleges one of the gunmen was inspired by ISIS, Commissioner Barrett stresses there's no evidence to suggest they were part of a broader terrorist cell.
However, I want to be clear, I am not suggesting that they were there for tourism.
They were quite focused, and the fact that they would have spent a lot of time in their room.
Katia Theodorakis is an independent terrorism and extremist expert who's researched ISIS operations in the Philippines. She's also the former head of counterterrorism at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
They may have visited also places of worship. Maybe they were meeting with people. So it's no coincidence, I would say, that they went to the one place at the edge of the Bangsamoro Autonomous Zone, where ISIS tried to establish a caliphate for Southeast Asia.
As for the commissioner's point that the alleged gunman acted alone, Katia Theodorakis explains there's been a shift in the past decade that's seen ISIS incite individualised attacks.
There are connections to broader patterns and networks. And I don't think the commissioner was inferring in any way that they're not looking at this. I think she was just asked to give an update of what they've found out so far.
And during that update, Commissioner Barrett was asked if the pair were supported in Australia. She said that's part of the investigation, but declined to talk further. Speaking more broadly, she addressed the issue of hate preachers. The AFP has been going through sermons line by line, seeking advice on charging those who incite hatred towards the Jewish community.
We've been focused on these hate preachers and their sermons for a long time, over the last 2 years. This is not something that has started in the last few weeks.
Commissioner Barrett says the federal government's plan to strengthen hate speech laws will be very helpful in bringing cases to court.
Kimberly Price and Isabel Masali reporting there. The search for the wreckage of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 is back on more than 11 years after the plane went down with 239 people on board. The aircraft was supposed to fly from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, but experts believe it crashed into the southern Indian Ocean, thousands of kilometres off course. There are hopes that if search teams can find the fuselage and black boxes, it could end one of aviation's most enduring mysteries. Angus Randall reports.
For 11 years, Jeanette Maguire has been hoping for answers over the disappearance of her sister Kathy Lawton and brother-in-law Bob on Malaysia Airlines flight MH370.
There's not a day goes by that we as a family don't think of Kath and Bob, you know, that they're always in our thoughts.
Six Australians were among the 239 people on board the plane when it went down on what should have been a six-hour flight between Kuala Lumpur and Beijing. Now, a new search could be just days away from finding the wreckage of MH370.
Very anxious, I suppose, in one sense, that it obviously stirs up a lot of memories and, you know, you get that real sick feeling in your tummy. But overall, we're looking forward to the search. Hopefully this time we get really good news and they find them.
The Malaysian government has approved the latest expedition, covering around 15,000 square kilometres, far off the coast of Western Australia, over 55 days. US-based marine robotics firm Ocean Infinity is doing the actual searching under a no-find, no-fee deal with the Malaysian government. If the wreckage is discovered, it will earn a $106 million finder's fee. So why now? Geoffrey Thomas is the aviation editor at Business News.
This started in May of last year in 2024, where Ocean Infinity presented new evidence of a location of MH370 based on the work of UK aerospace engineer Richard Godfrey using what's called whisper technology. I'm very confident that, in fact, we will find it based on his technology.
This whisper technology follows a theory that aircraft disturb long-distance radio waves as they pass by. If you follow those disturbances, then, in theory, you can track a plane's path.
And since 2009, all these whisper signals, that's what they're called, weak signal propagation reporter, have been stored in an international database So you're able to go back and find the exact time, location, etc., of MH370, the last known position, and then track the disturbance in the radio waves to find a new location.
More than 230,000 square kilometres have been searched in previous expeditions, but only small pieces of debris were ever found. If the fuselage is spotted and the two black boxes are recovered, Geoffrey Thomas says it should shed some light into why the plane went down.
It'll be critical to finding out exactly what happened to this aircraft and why. That may take quite a few months to analyse that data, if indeed they do find the black boxes and if indeed they are still readable.
Jeanette Maguire is hopeful this search will be successful, but she's been through this journey many times before.
Technology has obviously increased since the last time there was a search. So I think putting all of that together would be absolutely wonderful, and if they found it. However, I'm still being a little bit reserved, I suppose, and I'm not giving into it fully, just to say, okay, you know, what if they don't find it again after 55 days? Then we're back to where we were.
Ocean Infinity will search intermittently for a total of 55 days, so it could be several months before the search is complete.
Angus Randall there. Saudi Arabia has issued an ultimatum to its supposed ally, the United Arab Emirates, to withdraw its forces from Yemen and cease sending weapons and money to Yemeni separatists. It follows Saudi strikes on a weapons shipment from the UAE and attacks on militant camps in southeastern Yemen over the past week. The UAE said it would pull its personnel out of Yemen, but this might not be the end of a conflict which threatens to send southern Yemen back into civil war. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
In dramatically soundtracked video released by the Saudi press agency, drone footage shows vehicles being unloaded at Mukalla port in Yemen. The Saudi-led military coalition in Yemen says the ships came from the United Arab Emirates and were delivering weapons and military vehicles to separatist groups in areas along the Saudi border. It says it then bombed the weapons and vehicles to prevent their delivery, the most recent of several strikes by Saudi-led forces over the past week. Elizabeth Kendall, a Yemen specialist from Cambridge University, says the strikes are a major escalation.
We're seeing something really new here. This is about as risky as it gets. We are teetering on the brink of open conflict between two major regional Middle Eastern powers, Saudi Arabia and UAE, which is about to boil over potentially in Yemen.
Both Saudi Arabia and the Emirates intervened in Yemen's civil war just over a decade ago as the major players in a coalition fighting the Iran-backed Houthi rebels in the north. But the Saudis and the Emiratis support different factions in southern Yemen, making them rivals as much as allies. Dr. Kendall says Saudi Arabia may fear it's being encircled by the UAE and Israel, which is making moves into the region with a new partnership with the territory of Somaliland on the other side of the Gulf of Aden.
Now with its ally in the Abraham Accords, Israel, recognising Somaliland as an independent entity, as a sovereign entity, then that looks very much like a stranglehold on these areas surrounding very important waterways.
Saudi Arabia gave the UAE 24 hours to withdraw its forces and cease all assistance to any party inside Yemen, accusing the Emirates of taking dangerous steps which threaten security along its border. The Emirates denied it was sending weapons and vehicles to the separatists and says it had coordinated the shipment of military vehicles with its coalition partner. Yemeni analyst Maysa Shuja-Eddin, a senior researcher at the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies, says any new conflict could have serious repercussions for civilians in Yemen.
I'm very worried about the humanitarian situation that is going to be in the south. This region was safe. Both governments received a lot of internal displaced people during the war. So now there is no place safe for the Yemenis.
The situation in Yemen received international attention during the Gaza war because the Houthi rebels in the north attacked international shipping in the Red Sea and fired missiles at Israel, purportedly in support of Palestinians. But otherwise, the protracted conflict has often been overlooked in the West, even though it's had horrific and long-running humanitarian impacts. Maysa Shuja-Adin says this new development could further complicate and prolong the war.
The people already are exhausted after one decade of a very intense war. It will take longer time, it will be more complicated, and it's more difficult to conclude it.
That's Yemeni researcher Maysa Shuja-Adin ending that report from Eric Torchek. A new scheme for supporting older Australians to live independently at home came into force last month. It's part of a major reform to improve aged care, but some advocates say they've been inundated with calls from people warning they've been left worse off. Isabel Masali reports.
April Stanley Banks left her nursing job to become a carer for husband Michael after he suffered two strokes. She says government funding, under what was called the home care package, allowed the 80-year-old to have consistent access to meaningful services, including regular physio and podiatry.
But then, as of the 1st of November, the prices for the hourly rates have doubled. And now we're finding that the bare essential services that Michael's now receiving is going to more or less be halved.
She's not alone in reporting price hikes from care providers since the start of the new system called Support at Home. So she requested a reassessment, and Michael's been approved for more funding. But they have no clue when that will start and fear they'll still be worse off.
We don't know where we stand. We're going into this situation completely blind. And yet, Michael really needs to have what little services he's got left in order for us to sustain this situation where we can stay at home and live a dignified, quality sort of lifestyle, if you know what I mean. It seems to be a big money grab, and people have lost sight of the fact that in there somewhere is a disabled individual.
Someone might have been on a home care package level 3 before and was under the no worse off principle, the grandfathered packages, so they're not going to pay any more towards their care.
Craig Gear is from the Older Persons Advocacy Network.
But because the funding amount is the same, and we know that providers have increased their prices for the per hour rates, it means that the levels of services that a person is actually receiving has reduced. And we're concerned about that, that people are going without needed personal care and supports or clinical care because of those price increases.
He says overall the changes to the aged care system are positive, but he wants the government to monitor for unintended consequences and take action. His network's been receiving hundreds of calls a day since the new program began. Federal MP and member of the Centre Alliance Party, Rebecca Sharkey, says her office has experienced a similar issue.
I've been a member of parliament for nearly 10 years and I have never seen the system so bad. I've never been contacted by so many people about different areas of home care that are just not meeting the basic needs in order for somebody to stay at home, to safely stay at home. It really does keep me up at night.
From July next year, price caps will be in place for services. Rebecca Sharkey says it's clear this lack of a cap has had a huge impact on costs, and she's alarmed by wait time data revealed in Senate estimates this month.
The system's failing at the moment if you have over 100,000 people who are waiting to be assessed, and effectively up to 100,000 people who have been assessed and dying waiting for their package to come through. We also need a system that's affordable for people, and I don't think the government has the calculations quite right with respect to co-contributions.
In a statement, the Minister for Aged Care and Seniors, Sam Ray, said the government's already built in a range of measures to ensure providers keep prices reasonable and is watching closely as people transition into the new system. He went on to say the number of people waiting for assessments and packages has reduced in recent months, and it's well underway in allocating an extra 83,000 home care places this financial year.
Isabel Masali reporting there. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm David Lipson.